habits. The February, when every single one of them was down with the flu, and still they sang 7 times each day. The sight of the postulants lined up in the meadow doing their morning jumping jacks as the dogs looked on, barking. How, on a chilly Saturday, 10 of them might gather out in the barn to put up the hay, sweating in peaceful silence as they went about their work. They were the ones she laughed and cried with, the ones whose trials she worried over, the ones whose quirks drove her mad and delighted her in equal measure. They were her sisters now, her family. Part 7, 2009. Chapter 19. Bridget stood outside the door to the funeral home in the cold, keeping her Aunt Kitty company while she smoked a cigarette. It seemed a bold gesture, as if Kitty were giving the finger to death itself. Nobody smoked anymore. Yet here she stood, smoking, because she was 82, it was what she had always done, and she was too old now to change. For the past few years, Kitty had lived in a retirement community, a nice one, where everybody had his or her own little condo, where they did yoga and had Italian cooking demonstrations on Friday nights. She always seemed to be dating someone new. Her eyesight was shot, so she couldn't drive anymore, but she kept her old Cadillac parked out front. "In case of emergency," she said. Bridget and Natalie had gone to pick her up. Now Natalie was inside with the others. The only one who had yet to arrive was Brian. Since he appeared to be half in the wrapper back at the house, Bridget had tried to insist that he go with someone else instead of driving his own car. "I'm fine to drive," Brian said.
"He's fine," Nora said.
She wondered why her mother would rather risk seeing another son drive into a concrete wall than experience an awkward moment. But Bridget left it alone. The fact was, all of them had been in a car with a driver who had been drinking a million times, thinking nothing of it. She remembered when she was 6 or 7 and in the middle of a family party, her mother sent her and John and their cousins along to the package store with their Uncle Matthew. He swerved onto the curb. He whooshed past red lights.
"It was pink," he said.
They laughed and laughed. A great adventure. Kitty's scalp was visible beneath tufts of white cotton candy hair. "You need a hat," Bridget said. Kitty waved her away.
"It would wreck my whole look."
Under her fur coat, she wore a black velour pantsuit with rhinestones on the front, a pair of black patent leather flats. She was once a tall and striking woman, but years of slouching had left her hunched. Bridget straightened her own spine, looking. From this close up, Kitty's deep wrinkles seemed punishing. Her face looked like the shell of a walnut. Bridget had last seen her at Christmas, but she swore that even in the span of a few weeks, Kitty had gotten smaller. There were so many years in the middle of life when a person didn't change much, but old age was like childhood, when if you went a month without seeing someone, you might find an entirely different person waiting. Despite it, Kitty was somehow still a beauty. Her high cheekbones, her sparkling eyes remained. She still wore red lipstick every day. Bridget worshipped her as a kid. Kitty was the opposite of her mother. Carefree, living alone off her dead husband's money, not having to worry about children. Kitty retired early from nursing. She took expensive trips and wore nice clothes. Her home was furnished in such a feminine manner that every time Bridget stepped inside, she felt as if she had entered a gingerbread house. There were ruffles on the curtains, pink wallpaper, and silk flowers in glass vases. Throw pillows, a mirrored coffee table, a crystal chandelier. In the tiny garden out back stood an honest-to-God bird bath, gurgling water at all times. Taking in the smell of her aunt's perfume now, Bridget had a recollection of Kitty as a young woman, sitting in her mother's kitchen in a black dress, a highball glass in hand, auburn hair falling past her shoulders, everyone laughing at the story she told. It had occurred to Bridget on the drive over that Kitty, having grown up next to her mother in Ireland, must already know. Telling her wouldn't be a betrayal. "Aunt Kitty, can I ask you something, just between us?" "Of course," Kitty said. "My mother told me she has a sister." Kitty pulled her head back in surprise.
"She told you?"
"Yes. I assume you knew." "I knew Teresa. I shared a room in that house on Edison Green with her and your mother when they were new in town." Bridget looked at her. It was all so strange and suspicious. And maybe it was childish to feel this way, but it stung a little that Kitty had kept this from her. Why this, when for all of Bridget's life, Kitty had been the one to fill in the gaps in the family story? She was the one who told Bridget that Uncle Lawrence had once been a wild drunk, that he didn't stop drinking until he fell asleep behind the wheel of a bus. The kids knew him as a teetotaler. They only ever saw him drink tonic, though he was a fiend for the stuff. He could wash a sandwich down with a 2-liter bottle of Coke like it was a glass of water. Something awful must have happened. This woman must have hurt her mother in a way that left no room for forgiveness. "What was she like?" Bridget asked.
"A real hot ticket," Kitty said. "Beautiful girl. She looked like a film star."
Her Irish aunts said any woman who was halfway pretty looked like a film star, the generous words tumbling out of them, one syllable stretched into two, film. "What else?" Bridget said. She felt far freer to ask Kitty about it than she did Nora. For a certain kind of girl with a certain kind of mother, an aunt would always be the preferred confidant. An aunt could see you as you were. A mother could only see you as she wished you were, or once imagined you would be. "It was quite a scandal when Teresa ran off the way she did," Kitty said.
"Ran off?"
"We were all shocked when we found out she had become a nun, I can tell you that. Your mother included, I'd say, though we never discussed it. Your Aunt Teresa certainly wasn't the type, clearly."
Your Aunt Teresa. Another aunt.
Bridget hadn't thought of it in those terms. Who knew how they might have connected if given the chance? Probably not very well. She couldn't picture herself as close with a nun as she was with Kitty. But still.
"My mother says we kids met her once."
Kitty frowned.
"No, I don't think so."
"I don't either. I'm confused. Why did we never hear about this person until today?"
"I never thought it was right for Nora to keep it a secret. But of course, I didn't say anything."
"Why not?"
"Oh, Bridget. You can only control what goes on in your own house, and sometimes not even that. But if you ask me, Patrick deserved to know."
"Why Patrick?" She saw something change in Kitty's expression.
All of you did, I mean. Well, what did your mother tell you about it?
She just said she has a sister and that she called her and she's coming to the wake.
No. What's Nora thinking? She can't come. They don't let them leave places like that.
There was a long silence while she waited for Kitty to say more. Usually, Kitty was thrilled when a secret got told. Then she could reveal all the other secrets that went along with it. To her, a secret was like a diamond, long buried, kept under pressure, then dug up and made into something so much more valuable than the thing it was to begin with. But for once, Kitty didn't elaborate.
I don't understand, Bridget said finally. Why did they stop speaking?
Kitty shook her head as if she couldn't quite remember.
It was such a long time ago now.
Bridget noticed a blonde walking toward them across the funeral home parking lot. The girl looked about 19. She gave them a wave. She wore a black mini dress with a plunging neckline and super high heels. No coat, even though it was freezing. Bridget was positive she had never seen her before. At that moment, Brian turned into the lot. When the blonde saw him, she smiled huge, a smile that hurt your jaw just looking at it. Brian got out of his car and walked toward the three of them, hunched down in his jacket, hands pressed into his pockets. When he reached them, he said,
"So, I see you've met."
"No, actually," Bridget said.
"Hi, I'm Bridget, his sister."
"This is Ashley," Brian said.
"His girlfriend," Ashley said.
Kitty tossed her cigarette and they all filed inside. Brian held the door. Bridget was the first one through, providing a chance for her to raise her eyebrows at him. She made her way toward Natalie.
"I was just talking to Kitty about the nun," she said.
Natalie nodded. Nora stood whispering with Mr. O'Dell at the center of the enormous viewing room, even though there was no one there to take issue with their volume. John and Julia were with her. Maeve was arranging photographs on a table while also typing away on her phone. Bridget wondered what she thought of all this. She wished desperately, suddenly, that John and Patrick had been closer, so that Maeve might have known Patrick better, the parts of him that were easy to love. The open casket had been positioned in its usual place against the far wall. There were flowers arranged all around it, enormous baskets of lilies, roses, tulips, and orchids, all white. A potted white hydrangea, which would eventually be planted at the grave. Her mother needed things to be just so, everywhere, but especially here. As if she could change the fact of death itself if she exerted enough control over the situation. Bridget hated this place, the forced hush that covered over all the anguish, the pale pink walls like the inside of a shell, a color that was probably meant to soothe, but had the opposite effect on her. She felt a strong desire to punch a hole through the inspirational psalm scrawled in calligraphy on one wall. "Cast your cares on the Lord, and he will sustain you. He will never let the righteous be shaken." She thought to herself, not for the first time, that she would never put the rest of them through this. She wouldn't be waked. All of them standing here, weighted down by numb sorrow, forced to look at her corpse or not look. Of course, it might not be up to her. Pat wouldn't have wanted any of this. She would make it clear to Natalie the minute they got home that were she to die, Nora could have nothing to do with it.
Natalie was to tell her that Bridget's body had vanished. Julia came over to the two of them.
"Nora just told us the craziest thing in the car on the way here," she whispered.
"We know. She told me too," Bridget said. "Insane." Before they could say more, the priest walked in.
"Let's talk about it later," Julia said.
"Yes, at great length." They went toward the casket as a group, following the priest across the room as if he were the Pied Piper. The sweetness of the lilies made Bridget want to gag as she got close. She had long associated the smell of lilies with death. She avoided them at the bodega or on a table in a restaurant. They belonged nowhere but here.
"Is this everyone?" the priest said.
He had his back to the casket while the rest of them were made to face it.
"Yes," Nora said.
She paused as if to count them.
"This is the whole family."
"Used to be a lot more of us," Kitty said.
Aunt Kitty's favorite pastime was to tell you over a cup of tea how each of her brothers had died. The next day she'd run through it all again if you let her. It seemed to hurt her feelings that she had outlived them all, as if God had snubbed her somehow. Bridget wondered if her mother was expecting her sister to be here by now. She imagined what they would do when they saw each other. Embrace, maybe, or start weeping. Explain to the rest of them why the hell they hadn't spoken in so long. She let her eyes land on Patrick's face, felt a jab to the heart, then looked away. Just above his head, inside the casket, leaning against the raised silk-covered lid, was a framed picture of him. In it, Pat was sunburned and smiling, sitting on the front porch in shorts and T-shirt, the breeze in his hair. Bridget focused on that. She didn't face him again until it was time for them each to take a turn with the body. The family members lined up. From the corner of her eye, she saw Natalie go to the back of the room to give them space. Bridget knelt before him first, crossing herself for her mother's benefit. The tears were automatic. Patrick held a crystal rosary in his hand. In this way, she knew for certain that he was dead. Bridget half wanted to grab the thing, stuff it in her pocket. It had nothing to do with him. For some time, Patrick had been wearing a mustache. Nora moaned about it every time Patrick was in her presence. Now, the mustache was gone. Bridget assumed Nora had requested this for the viewing. She wondered whose job it was to outfit the dead in so intimate a manner. Would Mr. O'Dell, that moon-faced man, be the last person ever to see Patrick's scarred-up knees, his freakishly long white toes? The Hail Mary was a muscle memory that came to her in moments like this, even though she hadn't been one to pray in years. She had tried once to attend a Unitarian Universalist church service, but she couldn't locate God there, in that place of rainbows and kindness. She found it all suspect somehow. In times of distress, she returned to the God of her childhood, vengeful yet dependable. She said every prayer she knew, just to have more time with Patrick. The moments you spent with the dead were like going underwater. The sounds of the room went away, and there was nothing but you and the person lying before you. When she finally stood, Bridget felt disoriented. She looked around at the others, her family, what remained of her family. When it was Nora's turn to say goodbye, she knelt before Patrick, and though she did not make a sound,
Bridget watched from behind as her body heaved up and down, the silent sobs rolling through her. She stayed too long. Eventually, John went to her, rubbed her back, as if drawing her out of a trance.
"It's almost time," he said. "People will start coming in a minute."
Brian went last. The girlfriend went right along with him. She knelt beside Brian, putting a bare arm around him, rubbing his back, as if the two of them might just go at it right there on the velvet kneeler. John gave Bridget a baffled look. Here was Brian, putting front and center a girl they would probably never see again after today. Bridget caught Natalie's eye, off to the side, keeping a respectful distance. The woman who would be the mother of her child. It was no one's fault but Bridget's. She was more like her mother than she cared to admit. Nora was closed off, unable to show herself to them, and this had seeped down to Bridget, cost her enormously. A few minutes later, when the priest said, "Immediate family members should take their places," Natalie said, "I'll keep Aunt Kitty company."
"No," Bridget said, "stay with me."
Natalie nodded, and Bridget took her hand, led her to their position. The two of them stood beside John and Julia and Maeve, Nora and Brian on the other side. Bridget didn't look to see her mother's expression. The seven of them formed an L with the casket, as erect as soldiers or rockets. There was a row of tall stools behind them, but none of them sat. Poor Brian's eyes and nose were red with tears that he refused to release. It looked as if they might burst through his pores at any moment. They accepted condolences from a long line of relatives and friends, strangers and near strangers. Hundreds of people showed up. Bridget's cousins Mattie and Sean and Connor were first, plus Connor's wife Marie and their kids. They looked like a family from a catalog. His three sisters, Peggy, Patricia, and Jane, all of them nurses, followed behind. Two of them wore scrubs beneath their winter coats, only on an hour's break. Bridget's parents had presumed once that she too would be a nurse someday. There was a pair of twins, third cousins of Bridget's, a woman and a man 10 years younger than she was. She still remembered their christening party, though she could never remember their names. Each of them had two children of their own now. Everyone they knew from Dorchester was there, and the neighbors from Hull. Guys who hadn't seen Patrick since high school came, and all the regulars from his bar. If you never had a wedding, your family never got to see the people who loved you in all the different parts of your life, together in one place. There was something beautiful about it. She wished Patrick were here to see. Oh, the women who poured into his wake. She wondered now whether he ever would have settled down with one of them. Aunt Kitty had taken a seat by the fireplace. Every so often she gave Bridget a regretful wave. Nora's eyes were on the door. An hour passed. The room hummed with low conversation. Dozens of people stood talking in small groups. 50 or more waited in line to pay their respects. Eileen Delaney, queen of the neighborhood busybodies, was there with Betty Joyce, who lived next door to her. When they reached the coffin, they knelt together, their hips and shoulders touching. Then they came to Bridget and Natalie, who were first in the receiving line. "Honey, how are you?" Eileen said. Her voice dripped with the sad enthusiasm of a tragedy junkie. Eileen could go on for hours talking gleefully about someone else's divorce or heart attack or house fire. She lived for days like this one. Betty embraced Bridget, the smell of her perfume making Bridget want to cough. When they kissed, she felt Betty's prickly whiskers on her cheek. "Didn't he get a crowd?" Eileen said. "The back lot was already full when I pulled in. There's an actual line of cars just waiting to park." Natalie looked slightly taken aback by the remark, but Bridget understood. They had all been in this room so many times. You couldn't help but compare it to Wake's past. An untimely death drew the biggest turnout. The younger, the bigger. Every few years, it seemed, some teenager in town got in a wreck or broke his neck jumping drunk into the shallow end of a swimming pool. There'd be a line that stretched for blocks. Usually, when they were young, there was memorabilia that hinted at a hobby of some kind, a track jacket draped over the coffin, or an electric guitar propped among the flower arrangements. This told you how the child would be remembered. He was the captain of the team, they'd say for years to come, even if he spent all his time warming the bench. He was going to be the next Clapton. Patrick was 50. Certainly not a child, not even a young man anymore, and yet still too young to die. A few in the room were just beginning to feel the crush of grief that would last for years. But many didn't even know him. They had come for the spectacle, or because they knew one of the Rafferty kids from school, or because they wanted something from John. They were thinking about where they'd go to eat after. They were establishing themselves as important to the story or not. Bridget wished she could trade places with any one of them.
"Patrick looks so handsome," Betty said.
"He does," Eileen said, "very peaceful." She lowered her voice. "Though Digger O'Dell always makes the hair too big. It's like he thinks the dead might have a gig at the Grand Ole Opry later. Well, we'll see you back at your mother's after." There wasn't anything more to say, but some old biddy had created a backup in the line, holding John's hand, probably telling him a story he wouldn't remember an hour from now. Eileen smiled at Bridget, holding eye contact for an uncomfortably long moment. When Brian was born, Nora and Charlie had to go to the hospital in the middle of the night. Eileen came up the hill in her nightgown and slept over so the others wouldn't be alone. She was there when they woke up to tell them the news. She made pancakes, and afterward they decorated the porch with blue balloons. It was the summer they moved to Hull, when Patrick was in such a bad way. When Bridget saw Eileen in the kitchen that morning, her first thought was that something horrible had happened to him.
"Oh!" Eileen exclaimed now. She flapped her arms. "There's my Tommy!"
Tommy Delaney shuffled toward them, dragging his feet, flashing apologetic smiles at all the people he was cutting in line. He got to his mother's side and kissed her cheek. He had gotten fat. His gut hung over the top of his pants so that his suit jacket wouldn't close.
"Hi, Ma," he said. "Mrs. Joyce." "Bridget, hi." "God, I'm so sorry for your loss."
"Thanks, Tommy," she said. "Thanks for coming." After the three of them had moved along, Natalie whispered,
"My competition, I presume?"
"Yep," Bridget said. "I can tell you're shaking in your boots." Patrick's best friend Fergie had arrived, bleary-eyed and drunk. He took his place in line. Bridget kept an eye on him. When he reached her, they made small talk for a while. She didn't want him to move along to the others. She worried how Nora might feel, seeing him like this. Her mother had never liked Fergie. It was always easier to blame someone else for your kid's bad behavior. But finally, Bridget couldn't think of anything more to say. She watched him move through each family member on the way to Nora at the end of the line. When Fergie said something that made Brian laugh out loud, the sudden eruption of noise startled Bridget. People turned their heads. She looked to Julia on the far side of Natalie. They held each other's gaze. Julia whispered, "Well, that was unexpected." She paused, then added, "What is Brian's date wearing?" Bridget thought the word "date" was odd, given the context. Natalie leaned in. She's auditioning to be a Laker girl after this. Throughout the afternoon, they all checked in with Nora to make sure she was holding up. They offered her tissues and cushioned chairs and glasses of water, none of which she wanted. "I'm fine," she kept saying. "There's no need to make a fuss." As the hours wore on, the members of the family fell out of line and joined the crowd. Bridget and Natalie drifted from one set of cousins to another, then stood chatting with Maeve and Julia for a while.
"My dad punched a lamp last night," Maeve said.
"Is that right?" Bridget said.
"Yeah, healthy."
"And who have you been texting all day?" Natalie asked. Maeve looked bashful.
"Nobody."
"It's a boy in her class," Julia said. "Jacob Owens."
"Mom!"
Maeve said. She was truly outraged, and yet Bridget had to smile. She thought her sister-in-law was an amazing mother. Julia knew Maeve, knew all her friends, unlike Nora, who always gave Bridget something generic for her birthday when she was a kid, a doll or a tea set, something you might give a child you'd never met simply because she was a girl. When Bridget was young, there was absolutely nothing fun about her mother. Nora was strict, stern, matter-of-fact. She had no interest in knowing anything about Bridget's personal life. Julia knew which clothing brands and TV shows and bands Maeve liked. She knew which members of the bands were considered the cutest and weighed in with her own opinion. She knew Maeve hated beets, so she simply did not make beets, whereas Nora would have served them up as something close to a punishment. It seemed unjust that Maeve hated Julia's guts all the same, as if it were written into the code of being 13, and no behavior on a mother's part could change that. Julia was looking at Nora, who stood talking to the priest.
"How do you think she seems?" she said.
"I don't know," Bridget said.
"She never lets on, does she? This phantom sister of hers hasn't shown."
"Is it possible she made the whole thing up?" Julia said. "I'm not accusing her of anything, but just maybe in her grief she got her wires crossed? Sorry, is that terrible to suggest?"
"No, I was thinking the same thing. But Aunt Kitty remembers her."
"All I ever wanted was a sister," Maeve said. "How could Nana have one and not speak to her? Something bad must have gone down between them, that's all I know."
Julia smiled, shook her head.
"I concur," she said.
Half an hour before the wake ended, Bridget slipped into the bathroom. She peed in one of two tiny stalls, then washed her hands in a pink sink built into a pink countertop. There were flecks of gold glitter in it. The walls were covered in the same pink tile as the floor. On the counter sat a large basket containing breath mints and tissue packets and eye makeup remover, a morning survival kit. chipper classical music was piped in through an overhead speaker. She regarded her reflection in the mirror, touching the creases beneath her eyes. She looked exhausted. The door creaked open. Her body tightened, preparing for more small talk, readying itself to be trapped with some acquaintance from her past. But when she looked over, it was her mother who had entered the room. Nora seemed in a daze. In her hand was a stack of mass cards people had given her, declarations of sympathy, promises that Patrick would be prayed for. She held them forth, and Bridget scanned the words. In life and death we belong to the Lord. It is in dying that we are born to eternal life.
I don't want these, Nora said. I don't want to see them.
Bridget took the pile and shoved them into the trash can. There.
We can't, Nora said. What if someone sees?
Bridget balled up a wad of paper towels and tossed it on top. For a second, Nora smiled. Bridget wondered if her mother would mention Natalie's presence beside her in the receiving line. But instead, Nora said,
When your father died, everyone had something to say about it. They asked so many questions about whether the doctors had done enough, whether they could have tried one more treatment. They talked about their cousins and their friends and total strangers who died of the same thing he did. It made me very uneasy. I don't believe in talking about such things.
Okay, Bridget said, unsure where this was headed.
But now they don't say a thing about what happened to Patrick, Nora said. Maybe they think I'm to blame. I let him get away with murder all those years. What did I expect?
What? No. Mom, he was 50 years old.
She supposed this was how it worked. A mother blamed herself until the end, whatever that meant. Would Bridget feel this way about her own child in 50 years' time? She tried not to think about how old she would be by then. Nora lifted a soggy prayer card from the counter where someone had left it behind.
Oh, no, will you look at this?
The card was printed on flimsy paper, a photo of Patrick on one side and a prayer on the other. Nora had had 200 of them made. Bridget herself always took one at a wake to be polite, but she never knew what to do with it after. She would sometimes find a prayer card at the bottom of her bag or under the seat in her van, a startling reminder of someone she hadn't thought of in ages. Nora had a place for everything. In her house, every object had at least one other object to contain it. A ring was never left on a table or even naked in a jewelry box, but was instead suspended over the crystal post of a Waterford ring holder or tucked into the velvet box it had arrived in decades earlier. She kept her lipstick in a magnetized case. When they were kids, a ridiculous doll sat on the toilet lid with an enormous crocheted skirt like Scarlett O'Hara's. Under the skirt was a single roll of toilet paper. A fraying blue cardboard box held Nora's prayer cards. It had once had the words, Saints for All Occasions, embossed on the top in gold. But over time, bits of the foil had worn away so that only the shadow of the letters remained. Inside the box, at the bottom of the pile, were the newer cards, the ones she collected at wakes. The rest had been handed down by a long-dead relative Bridget had only ever heard about in stories. The cards were ancient and worn and fragile. Her mother kept them in a precise order and knew if even one was out of place. When they were young, Nora never let the children touch the cards unless she was sitting with them and they had washed their hands with soap and hot water. It was a clever trick, if that's what it was. It made the cards seem special, magical. They'd beg her to take them out. She had a prayer card for almost anything you could imagine. Bridget's favorite as a child was the prayer to Mary, Undoer of Knots. At some point in her teens, she realized that this had nothing to do with shoelaces or hair snarls, and came to like it even more. Nora took the limp, wet card now and held it under the hand dryer, shaking the picture of her son vigorously, as if attempting to save Patrick from drowning. When the dryer finished whirring, Nora said, "She didn't come." "I know. I'm sorry."
"You don't understand."
"Yes, I do," Bridget said, irritated. She was trying to be sympathetic. She was trying not to ask questions because she knew that's what her mother would want. "You're disappointed. You wanted her here."
"No, I didn't."
"But you invited her."
"I didn't know she could leave. Cloistered nuns aren't ever supposed to leave, and you should know that, Bridget."
"Jesus, you're being impossible. You didn't want her here, and she's not here. That's a good thing, right?"
Nora didn't say anything.
"So, after your sister became a nun, you just never spoke again?"
"We did speak, for many years. And then, we didn't anymore."
"Why?"
"It's too long a story for me to tell you here. People are probably wondering where we are."
"Why did you call her now?" Bridget said. But her mother was already at the door, pushing it open, crossing to the other side. Bridget followed Nora down a dark hallway. When they stepped back into the viewing room, there she was, standing by the fireplace, a nun in full habit, a veil and black robes that covered every bit of her besides her face. It felt as if they had summoned her out of thin air just by talking about her in the bathroom. Somehow, Bridget hadn't fully believed she was a real person until this moment. The nun was chatting with Aunt Kitty, just as natural as can be. Natalie, Julia, and Maeve stood several feet away, trying not to gawk.
"Oh, God," Nora said, her voice a frantic whisper. "She's here."
She grabbed hold of Bridget's hand, held it too tight. In all her life, her mother had never leaned on her in such a way.
"Let's go say hello," Bridget said, steadying Nora.
"I can't. Mom, come on." The nun didn't see them coming. They reached her just seconds after Kitty waved Bobby Quinlan over. Uncle Bobby, they had always called him, though he was not their uncle, but a distant cousin of her father's, the son of the woman who put them all up when they first came over from Ireland.
"Look who it is, Bobby," Kitty said. "Teresa Flynn. Do you believe it?"
"My God," he said. "We haven't seen you in years."
He turned and noticed Nora there.
"Nora," he said. "I didn't know your sister was coming."
The nun turned her head now and saw them.
"Nora," she smiled warmly with love. Bridget couldn't help but smile back.
The woman's eyes and mouth were so much like Nora's, like her own. Why was it a shock to learn that someone related to you resembled you? Of course she would. Nora didn't smile. She stared straight into the woman. Her mother was often appalled by what she saw as lapses in Bridget's manners. Now Bridget felt a need to apologize on Nora's behalf.
"Say something," she thought, attempting to beam the words to her mother's brain.
"I'm Bridget," she said finally, extending a hand. "Nora's daughter. Your niece."
"Bridget, my goodness, look at you. The last time I saw you, you were just a baby."
Everyone waited for Nora to speak. When she didn't, Bridget went on.
"Did you find the place okay? Where are you staying?"
"At the Ramada in Dorchester." An absolute shithole, right on the expressway. Bridget looked to her mother, but Nora stayed silent. The nun looked directly at her.
"I just booked the hotel closest to your house," she said. "I didn't realize the wake would be all the way out here."
Nora said coolly, as if it should be obvious, "We don't live there anymore." Bridget had never seen her mother be so rude to anyone other than the members of their immediate family.
"If you'll excuse me," Nora said, "I need to say goodbye to Father Callahan."
As she walked off, Bridget saw her mother's hands roll into fists. The nun looked despondent, watching her go. Bridget tried to imagine these two as children or young women on the boat to America, her mother tough and abrasive and self-assured, the sister a woman who would go to a convent eventually, probably shy and reserved, scared of Nora. What had happened between them? Everyone paused, absorbing the awkwardness, then attempting to deflect it.
"So," Bobby Quinlan said, "your convent is where now? Remind me."
"Vermont."
"Did you just come in today?"
"Yes, I took the bus."
"It was good of you to come," Bobby said.
"You don't drive?" Bridget asked, just to have something to say.
"I don't, unless you count a tractor."
The nun grinned, not shy then. She had a brightness to her eyes, a youthfulness almost. She was a sturdy woman. Aunt Kitty seemed brittle, as if her wrist might snap off if she let her arm dangle out the window of a moving car. Nora's body showed its age with a certain sag, as if having completed its work, it would now sink into an armchair and rest until the end. But the nun looked strong. Her face was weathered, tanned like a farmer's.
"Actually, I can drive," she said, "but I've never gone very far, just short distances."
"You don't go by Teresa anymore," Bobby said.
"No, it's Mother Cecilia now."
"Can I ask you something?" he said.
"Of course."
"Why do nuns change their names anyway?"
"Well, in my case, Mother Teresa was already taken."
They all laughed. Her mother's sister was charming, funny, totally unlike Nora.
"Where do you live now, Bridget?" she asked.
"I'm in New York."
"Whereabouts?"
"Brooklyn. I used to teach in Queens."
Bridget wanted to know when and whether Nora knew. She had barely gotten her head around the fact of the nun. She hadn't wondered what she did before the convent. Such a strange unfolding this day.
"I'm just going to go check on my mother," she said. "It's so nice to meet you."
"So good to see you, Bridget, after all this time."
She left the woman talking to Aunt Kitty and Bobby Quinlan. Always the story had gone like this. Your father was one of six. Your mother had just the one brother. A whole generation had known and said nothing. Maybe the secret had nothing to do with her, but it cast certain memories in a different light. She considered her father's inability to tell a story straight. She thought now of their trip to Ireland, a trip Nora never wanted to take. She was melancholy the entire time, even after she went to visit her old friend Una, the girl she'd been talking about since Bridget was small. "My best friend," Nora called her, even though they hadn't seen each other in decades. Bridget thought her mother's mood on that trip was down to Charlie being sick. But maybe there was more to it. Charlie's brother Peter and his two sons still operated the Rafferty farm at that point. Bridget had heard stories about Peter from her father and uncles. They said he was an irresponsible drunk when he was young. They expected him to run the farm into the ground. Instead, it had thrived in his care. When they visited, they all had lunch together there, laughing with ease as if they had done it 100 times. At some point, Peter mentioned something about how Charlie was the one who was meant to stay in Milltown Malby, the only one in the family who truly loved the farm. But her father breezed past the comment with a joke, and Bridget assumed Peter was kidding. Despite the many times Charlie had said he wanted to return for good, she couldn't begin to picture him in this life. In the early evening, Peter said, "Come on, I'll give you the grand tour." The whole group walked the land, green hills in the distance, and beyond them, the sun setting over the ocean. It was such a breathtaking place. Bridget couldn't understand how her parents had stayed away for so long.
"The boys will plant these 35 acres soon," Peter said.
35 acres, Charlie said. "But we've only got 23.
Bridget noted that "we."
"Not anymore," Peter said. "We've expanded."
"How?" "For a while, the Land Commission was given abandoned property to adjacent farmers once a certain amount of time passed. 20 acres went to me, and 15 to the Callanans on the other side of it."
Bridget saw her parents comprehend something that she herself didn't yet understand.
"My family's land," Nora said.
"It was just going to waste, Nora."
"What about the house?"
"Nothing's happened to it. It's still there, and in the Flynn name. Go on over and have a look."
Nora's people were all gone. Her only brother died in his 40s. Ever since, the house stood empty. They went inside, the front door ajar, everything coated in a veil of black dirt. There were dishes still in the sink, a calendar on the wall. April 1979. On the kitchen windowsill sat forgotten teacups, a package of cigarettes, an ashtray, and a yellowing photograph of Nora and Charlie and their children. The top half was bleached white from the sun, but Bridget recognized it as having been taken on an Easter Sunday from the shoes she was wearing and the new suede bucks on the boys. Throughout the house, paint curled off the walls. In the living room, letters and bills were heaped in the fireplace. By a recliner sat a pair of boots with metal horseshoes nailed into their heels.
"To make them last longer," Charlie said.
A picture of the Sacred Heart hung in the entryway, similar to the one their mother had in the kitchen back home. Down a short hall, in a downstairs room with bright blue walls and twin beds, chunks of the ceiling had fallen to the floor. Bridget followed her mother in.
"Was this your room?"
Nora nodded. She bit her lower lip.
"Unbelievable," she said. "He took my family's land, and he couldn't even be bothered to come over here and look in on our house."
Bridget pulled back the open bedroom door. A woman's hat was suspended on a hook on the rear side. A pink silk flower perched on the brim, perfectly preserved. She loved the thought of her serious mother wearing it once. Perhaps not so serious then. Bridget pulled the hat down, held it out to Nora. Nora took hold of it without a word. She said she wanted to go up to her grandmother's old bedroom, a cubby at the top of a short staircase, to see if her old sewing machine was still there. But Charlie said they'd better not try the stairs.
"Let's go now," he said.
Nora left the hat on a table in the entryway. As they walked back outside, she cried. Bridget watched as her brother Patrick wrapped an arm around Nora's shoulder. Nora smiled up at him through tears. Across the way, a herd of cows stared at them as if they knew something. Until then, Bridget had never thought of a cow as a particularly soulful animal, but she couldn't get the sight of their brown, puddly eyes out of her mind. Her father was able to turn his back and walk off, go to a pub and laugh the night away, point out sights that gave him pleasure. Nora couldn't do the same. She seemed haunted for the rest of that trip. Bridget wondered if they had been wrong to come. She asked her mother if they should do something. Maybe there was a way to restore the house. Even to sell it would be better than to let it collapse. But Nora said,
"It's too far gone. Just leave it, Bridget."
She hadn't mentioned it since. Bridget found her mother at the table by the door where the guest book sat. Nora acted busy, smoothing out the book's already flat pages, capping the cheap pen that leaned up against it.
"Mom," Bridget said, "aren't you going to talk to your sister?"
"Of course I will. But I have to talk to everyone. It's rude not to."
"You're not going to let her stay at the Ramada."
"Why not? It's perfectly fine."
"Should I invite her to the house after, to eat?"
"She's a nun. They don't go to things. We'll see her at the funeral."
"Are you sure?"
Nora's eyes had left the conversation. Bridget followed them. Her mother's sister stood alone now, over Patrick's body. They watched as she laid a hand on his forehead, stroking his hair.
"What is she doing?" Bridget said.
Nora shot off in her direction. One of the neighborhood ladies asked in a stage whisper,
"Oh my, who is that?"
"I assume she came with the priest," said Betty Joyce. "They're not salt and pepper shakers," Eileen Delaney said.
"Well, how else do you explain her?"
"I don't think she's anyone important," Eileen said. "Nora would have mentioned a nun." A moment later, Nora and her sister stood side by side, saying nothing, staring into the coffin. Everyone in the room, for as much or as little as they knew, grew silent at the sight. Chapter 20. Mother Cecilia sat at the hotel room window. The second floor was level with the expressway, maybe 100 feet away. She watched as cars whizzed past. Mother Placid had worried about her traveling alone. She told her to stay somewhere nice, spend some time. But Mother Cecilia didn't think it was proper. She booked the least expensive place she could find. She would only stay the one night, returning to the abbey after the burial. There were things that needed tending. When she woke this morning, she was still unsure about whether she should go at all, but Mother Placid insisted, and she knew her better than anyone. Just before she left, Mother Placid handed her a brown paper bag.
"The girls in the kitchen made you a lunch," she said. "We'll be thinking of you."
As her taxi drove through the Abbey gates, Mother